You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2019 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, Leading Ladies. This class is titled, Where May She Be Found? Wisdom's Story.
Good morning. Our leading lady this morning is again a form of office, although we're going to find this a strangely explicit way to name this person in a biblical context. We're going to consider the character of wisdom. Wisdom is herself named as a lady in the scriptures, mainly in the Proverbs, but as we'll see elsewhere as well. Here she is. I, wisdom, she says, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. It may be merely a collection of synonyms, but I do notice the mention of knowledge there. Wisdom possesses knowledge. Wisdom is not knowledge. We can't confuse the two. They are not written as synonyms in that construct. So don't confuse knowledge with wisdom. We can learn lots and lots of facts about things. That does not, by implication, that does not make us wise. And wisdom testifies even to the works of God, and from this we can determine her age, so to speak. She was there at the creation. She witnessed creation. I was there, she said, when God set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundaries so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. And she gives approval to the works of God himself. What do those clauses remind you of? Where may you have seen that elsewhere in Scripture? So it's, yeah, somewhat like Job. It's actually, the clauses are identical in some cases. These are deliberately identical words to God's first speech to Job, which forms a gentle rebuke at the front end. Because Job has actually challenged God's wisdom. This is an aside, of course, so I'll keep it real short. Job has challenged God's wisdom. Do you really know what you're doing? What are you doing? This is not right. You've wronged me. And God replies with this, were you there when I did this? Were you there when I did that? Which, in a way, is a rhetorical series of questions to say, Job, you know, back off a little bit. But there's actually more to it than that. It's not just that Job wasn't there. Someone else was. And her name is wisdom. Now, Job can't be familiar with these words that were written much later, obviously. But the point is that adds an extra level of dimension to God's answer to Job. He's saying, you're challenging my wisdom, and yet wisdom herself was there when I did these things, and you weren't. And she gave approval to my works. So they are wise, Job. I am working with you. So I find that very beautiful to take. I think the first speech of Job is underappreciated until you take these words from Proverbs 8. And interpret the first half of the first speech thereby. But that's for Job. For now, we're looking at Lady Wisdom, not the story of Job. And we're going to be in the Proverbs a little bit, simply because the purpose of Proverbs is defined hereby at the very beginning of the book. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction. It says, this is how you might come to know this lady. This is how you might come to form a relationship with her. This is what these proverbs are for. So it's a mechanism by which we can advance our relationship with Lady Wisdom. Who can find a virtuous wife? Solomon didn't pen these words. They're written by Lemuel, essentially Lemuel's mother. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. And she's equated with that same character as Lady Wisdom earlier in the book. And in chapter 1, wisdom is described this way. Out in the open, wisdom calls aloud. At the city gate, she makes her speech. So we're introduced to her as a very proactive, dominant character. She's walking out into the streets and saying, I am Lady Wisdom. I am available for any one of you men. And by that, she means humans. You can all come and meet with me. This is where the marriage metaphor gets mixed, of course. But you can all come and meet with me. You can all come and make your home with me. my house can hold as many as will come. Out into the street she goes. So she's not meekly sat by waiting for someone to approach her and open a conversation. She is speaking aloud in the streets. And while I was speaking aloud to mimic that, I saw someone turn the volume down on the mic. So yes, that she's a loud character, and rightly so. And what I find very beautiful is that that means that Solomon is paralleling wisdom with the ideal life partner. And this is not particularly a gendered argument. It's not just for men, you see, because wisdom is a lady. But the idea is, this is the ideal life partner. And as he's writing from a male perspective, he says, you know how much a man is always pursuing a woman? That's how much you should be pursuing wisdom. This should be your life goal, to find this partner and make a home together with her and make a family together with her with wisdom, so that the fruits that come out of your marriage with wisdom are themselves the children of wisdom. So I find it very attractive that wisdom is presented in this way as the ideal life partner for a person. Lady Wisdom, there she is, and she's mentioned, we'll read about her in chapter 1 and chapter 8, and also the final chapter, chapter 31 of the Proverbs. And as usual, there's presented a counterpoint. The idea is that if you don't make a marriage, make a relationship with Lady Wisdom, then you will end up with someone else. And the someone else is the seductress. And she's described in some detail in the 7th chapter of the Proverbs. And this is really going to be an either or. You're not going to end up single. You are either going to be seduced with what the society has to offer you, and it's presented in terms of hedonism as a dominant force in that society, and probably an even more dominant force today, or you will find and engage with Lady Wisdom. And so what I want to do, therefore, is explore those two separate leading ladies. And what we'll see is that, in a way, they're surprisingly similar. They do the same things. Lady Wisdom goes out into the streets and squares and calls to men, hey, come to my house. Come and make a home with me. Come to my bed, she will even call. And the beds are always described. I'll come to why that's pictures there in a minute. And the seductress does exactly the same thing. And the only difference is, by metaphor, the seductress goes out into the streets and squares by night and repeats pretty much exactly the same words. I call all men to come to me, to come and make a relationship with me and come to my home. And it's, again, always the bed is mentioned, and that makes a very obvious iconic figure of that which is that which represents an intimate relationship. And so, quite deliberately, I choose a bed here, and we'll see that there are four pillars of the character of wisdom. And so, just for sort of graphical ease, I'm going to consider the four massive pillars of this nice little trundle bed here. By which to represent, just as an aid memoir for me visually, to see the characteristics of Lady Wisdom's home. Who can find a virtuous wife, she's described. Her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. Lady Wisdom has virtue. And how interesting is that? Back in, you know, God himself has said, virtue is part of wisdom. Because I think that's something that today's society would say, if there's one thing you really don't need and it's just going to get in your way and impede you on the path to success and power and money and riches, it's virtue. Drop your virtues, drop your ethics, and you will be the more successful. I think there's never been a time in particularly the United States in which that spirit has been more to the fore. But God says no. Wisdom requires virtue. What else do we know about her? She gets up while it is still night. She provides food for her family and portions for her female servants. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. Lady Wisdom has a strong work ethic. She works hard. This is one of the pillars of this particular female character, this leading lady. What else do we see? Here we're talking about the bed coverings and the clothings, and they're often intertwined. She makes coverings for her bed. She herself is clothed in fine linen and purple. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies the merchants with sashes. Now, she is clothed in fine linen. A little biblical test here. Where else have we seen clothed in fine linen? In the Apocalypse. And what was the interpretation of that symbol? Because it's given to us. We don't have to guess. Exactly so. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given to Jesus' bride to wear. And we're given the interpretation, which is a rare thing, but a valuable one, because we can have confidence. Fine linen stands for the righteous acts of God's holy people. Thank you, John. Exactly so. Therefore, Lady Wisdom acts righteously. And this all sounds fairly obvious at the moment. We'll go somewhere a little more extended in a minute. Lady Wisdom acts righteously because she's clothed in fine linen. And also, let's not ignore purple. What would purple normally represent? So there's some hint of royalty about her. There's some enabling of royalty or clothing of royalty. So she acts righteously and in a royal manner, or has something to do with royalty. I didn't find a way to fit that in directly. And the fourth attribute we find of wisdom: I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. By me kings reign. So there's the royalty feature coming out very strongly now. And rulers issue decrees that are just. By me princes govern and nobles, all who rule on earth. Now, if you read that wrongly, it seems to suggest every single ruler is de facto and necessarily wise. And of course, we know from times past and present, that is clearly not the case. I think she's what's saying, everyone who rules wisely is a proper king. And you are not a proper king, and you are not a proper prince, and you are not a proper governor until you have married me, and until you are able to rule with wisdom. Lady Wisdom creates kings, proper rulers, as they should be. So then, let's go back to our little picture there and see those four pillars as we saw them, the four attributes of wisdom. Checking you're all still awake, what was the first one? Lady Wisdom is virtuous. And the second? Has a hard work, a strong work ethic. That's right. And the third? Has a bed linen of righteousness. Herself is enclosed in fine linen, as was the bride of Christ. And finally, creates kings. Enables kings to reign, or creates kings. I like that too. Good. So there are then the four pillars of the bed of Lady Wisdom. Okay. All fairly simple stuff at the moment. Let's now transition from there as if to a different bed. Similar in some respects. And yet so different. And let's see if we can identify the four pillars of the seductress's bed, because they're identified for us as well. There came out a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute and with crafty intent. She is unruly and defiant. Her feet never stay at home. Now in the street, now in the squares, at every corner she lurks. I haven't included the bit that says that's nighttime, but it is there in Proverbs 7. The seductress walks the streets and squares at night, in direct contrast and yet also similarity to Lady Wisdom, who walks the streets and squares by day. What else do we know her? I have covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. So there's a direct contrast with the bed linen of Lady Wisdom. Again, this is all highly esoteric and symbolic at the moment, but we'll get somewhere useful, a little further along. So in some way, the seductress reflects the land of Egypt. And Egypt not just as a random country, but Egypt as the precedental captor of God's people. Egypt, Babylon, Rome, these are the three main empires that really took hold of God's people and oppressed them. and Egypt the first thereof. So I have covered my bed with colored linens from the one who suppresses and represses and enslaves God's people. I think that's it's an important part to notice. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon, which is a word I can nearly say. We'll be talking about myrrh and aloes in future. Myrrh and aloes are a very interesting symbol. Where have we seen myrrh and aloes before? Or just myrrh, if you like. Christ's burial for myrrh and aloes is absolutely right, Norm. And where else have we seen myrrh? Yeah, that's right. So the Magi, the wise men, bowed down and worshipped Jesus. They opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And a common interpretation, almost a traditional interpretation, from which I do not depart, is that each of these types of gift were to symbolize a role that Christ was to fulfill. The gold was to symbolize his role as a king, as one brings gold to a king. The incense or the frankincense was perhaps to emblemize his role as a high priest, since a priest would burn the incense, and the myrrh would emblemize his role as what? As a sacrifice, as a corpse, to be simple. And I think I find this reinforced by the actual physical narrative measure, as Brother Norm pointed out, that when he was actually dead, this is how his body was physically adorned. Nicodemus, alongside Joseph of Arimathea, brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds worth, and taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices with strips of linen. So I think we're comfortable to say that myrrh is a representation of death. And in fact, Solomon very much will write that in Proverbs 7. The seductress's bed is perfumed with death. Okay? And then, finally, with persuasive words, she leads her man astray. She seduces him with her smooth talk. All at once, he followed her. So it's successful talk, it's a successful seductress. Like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. So the one whose bed is perfumed with myrrh, her house is actually a gate chamber or an antechamber to the grave itself. The seductress intentionally, it seems, whether intentionally or unintentionally, lures men away to their death. So those are the four pillars we can establish from the Proverbs of the character of the seductress. Let's recap again for those four. What was the first for the seductress? Night roams the streets by night, more explicitly, but you're absolutely right, Eric. And the second? Next, Egypt. I'm glad you're remembering, because my mind's going blank each time. So it's good. This is actually really working for me. Bed linen is from Egypt and somehow reflects Egypt. The third? Bed perfumed with death. And the final? Again, so this death theme is repeated. You might think, well, that's a pity you got the same one twice, but that's a very Hebrew thing. A means by which to give emphasis is to repeat. So she roams the streets by night. Her bed linen is from Egypt. This bed is perfumed with death. Indeed, her entire role is to lead men away to their death. So two very different women. And now at this point, let's just step back for a second to remind ourselves of an interesting and seemingly unusual fact. The books of the Bible as they are currently assembled are fine. I'm happy with them just the way they are. But the scroll order that the Jews would have held may have some relevance in teaching us a little message here. So let's just break into the books of the Bible. We're going to start at Job. And the next book after Job in our Bible is the Psalms. But in the Jewish scroll order, and here's my source for that, by the way, it's the book of Proverbs. And that's where we've come in. So we finish with Job and we open the book of Proverbs. And the next two books of the Bible in order are Ruth, which for us is buried way back before the Kings, maybe chronologically more accurately, who knows, and then the Song of Songs. And after the Song of Songs comes Ecclesiastes. This to me makes a great deal more sense because Ecclesiastes is clearly written by Solomon at the very end of his life. And we have Ecclesiastes and then we have the Song of Solomon. And I think that's what prompts us to say, well, the Song of Solomon must be the kingdom then if it's after Ecclesiastes, the end of Solomon's life. But that's not actually the order of the Jewish books. Job, Proverbs, Ruth, Song, Ecclesiastes, then the Lamentations of Jeremiah, and so forth. And these are what we might call, and a couple of others, including the Psalms as well, these are what we would call the wisdom books. There's a special word for that in Hebrew, which I've forgotten, so it doesn't matter. But anyway, these are the wisdom books, and this is where we are at the moment, looking at the Proverbs. We've also looked at the book of Ruth earlier, and that's going to prove more relevant than we might suppose. Here's what I want to do now. You've seen that before. What I want to do now is suggest to you that these abstract characters of Lady Wisdom and of the Seductress, in the Bible, God says, look, for those of you who really don't think too abstractly, I am going to present to you a human worked example of each one. That shouldn't be a surprise to you, because in the biggest picture of all, as God tries to communicate with humans, he tries to show us his character, and humans all too frequently fail to understand. And so God says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a worked example. And who is that worked example? Jesus. That is actually one way to summarize the entire work of Jesus, just one valid way, there are many. But one way to summarize the entire work of Jesus is like God saying, look, you don't really get this because it's too abstract thinking for you. Let me show you how I would appear as a man. If a man got it right and actually was completely godly, it would look like this. Let me send him to you so that you can see him and appreciate him and love him or hate him as you choose. And humanity therefore saw God, as Jesus said to Philip, saw the Father. And therefore also revealed their own nature because they saw it and said, well, this we have to destroy because that's the nature of humanity. If so be, therefore, that such an important example was worked out before us, it is very likely that we'll see that same thing going on with other abstract characters in the Bible. So here is Lady Wisdom and the quote you've seen before. The point is we're given a worked example of who this person is. Not that there's only one wise lady in the whole of the Bible. That's not what I'm saying at all. There is one very good emblemization of all these features. Who can find a virtuous wife? If you have a different translation, it may say a wife of noble character. Either will do. In either case, there's only one other appearance of that phrase attributed. Where is it attributed? I didn't hear that. I'm sorry. Jerry? Abigail. I think Abigail is a very wise woman. Excellent. It's not where that phrase lands, but that's a very fine guess. If you think carefully and use your context clues. Ruth, yes, that's right. That's always the way to guess intelligently. Even if, Ruth. Now, my daughter, do not fear, says Boaz. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. And there's that rare phrase in the abstract in Proverbs 31 and in the reality in Ruth chapter 3 there. And if it says in your Bible, a wife of noble character here, then it will say a woman of noble character here. It has been translated consistently, if differently, in either case. So it's Ruth who is a virtuous woman. That was just the first bedpost. The second bedpost, we read this already, she sets about her work vigorously. She has a strong work ethic. About whom is that true? It is true about Ruth. How do we know? Are we shown? We are shown very explicitly. One of the workers reports when replying to Boaz, well, she came into the field and has remained here from morning until now. And thereafter, Ruth gleans in that field until evening. Now realize, gleaning is an extremely inefficient harvesting process. You don't have a scythe and take a nice big swathe in a few seconds and get a big armful of stuff. You're picking up these stalks done nearly one at a time, right? She gleans until evening, and then she threshes herself She goes to the self-checkout, so to speak, and threshes her own barley and takes what she's gathered, which we're told is about, in modern terms, 40 pounds for the American contingent, 18 kilograms for the educated contingent. That's how much she's made to thresh, and then carries it back to town. How far is that? We're not actually told. We don't know. But she's got at least 40 pounds in her apron or in some sort of strung-together sack. And the Bible even says, and Naomi saw how much she had gathered. The sentence written entirely to say, this is an amazing amount of work. So this is a hard working. Her arms are strong for her tasks. And I think that's why we're given those explicit mathematical details, so that we can have an appreciation of the spiritual point. This is Lady Wisdom enacted. She makes coverings for her bed. She is clothed in fine linen. Fine linen, we've said, equals righteous acts. Fine linen stands for righteous acts of God's holy people. That's straight out of Scripture. And what do we find in Ruth? Boaz is prompted to say, I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And there begins this very intelligent and wonderful exchange that we looked at a couple of days ago. She acts righteously. Ruth is the one that's shown to us. I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. We saw that. By me kings reign. I create kings, says Lady Wisdom. And what's the closing words of the book of Ruth? It's the fact that she created, played her role in the genealogy, she created King David. Salmon was the father of Boaz, Boaz and Ruth the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. And the greatest king that has ever sat on Jerusalem's throne to date comes directly from the creation of, amongst others, his great-grandmother, Lady Wisdom. And Ruth, the book of Ruth, is written as a chiasm. We know that. Remember that picture? What's the use of a chiasm? It's an arrangement that says, I'm going to have the most important bit isn't going to be the punchline in this arrangement. It's going to be the bit in the middle. So I'm going to set the whole thing up so that your eyes are directed straight to the middle. And so we've looked at this. And so we have these tragic events, these sort of groomsmen or bridesmaids on this side. And then we have a central event, the spiritual union of Ruth and God, where Ruth chooses and says, your people will be my people, Naomi, and your God will be my God. And from that, we have the other bridesmaids or groomsmen or whatever, these actions here, which are all glorious. They're presented in direct couplets. We've done this before, so I can be quite swift. And it's around this central fulcrum that this axis of tragic events, all themselves are flipped about to their glorious counterparts. And that's the chiasm of the book of Ruth. Why are we seeing this again? Because that's saying, if this then is Lady Wisdom, and this is the center part, the essence of wisdom is the one who says, Israel's God will be my God. Not an easy or obvious statement to be able to make, and perhaps one not possible without calling, I can't say. But that essentially, this structure now says, if this indeed is Lady Wisdom, and we've seen from the four bedposts that she is, wisdom chooses to connect with God. And I find that a very beautiful and powerful thing with which to reinforce my own faith and my own attempts at meeting wisdom herself. So there's a slide we saw earlier that Proverbs presents in the abstract, both the Lady Wisdom on one side and the seductress of hedonism on the other side. And we've been able to actually physically identify an example, a worked example given to us in the Bible of Lady Wisdom herself. And we read all about it in the book of Ruth, which happens to be the adjacent book to the Proverbs, immediately downstream. As if, you know, here's the theory, and the next thing you need to know before you forget all about it and go do the laundry, here is the practical outworking. And it turns out we may be able to do the same for the seductress hedonism. Then came out a woman to meet him. Her feet never stay at home, the highlighted part, now in the street, now in the squares. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares, by night. I will search for the one my heart loves. This is the identical clause, and we find we can identify the seductress hedonism. It is, in fact, the Lebanese bride of the Song of Songs. Okay. We are complicated by the fact that we have inherited from mainstream Christianity the notion that the Song of Solomon describes the union between Christ and his bride. I've looked at that for 5, 6, 7 years, and I'm very comfortable that that is a misinterpretation entirely. Unfortunately, I can't take 5 talks aside to demonstrate that, but I will, at least by using the bedposts of the seductress, I hope to give a reasonably convincing case that that is true. I call her Lebanese because she is Lebanese. Just, we can spend one slide aside on that. The Song's bride is from Lebanon. Solomon indeed calls to her, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. And of course, we don't want to hinge any belief on a single verse, but we don't have to. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking toward Damascus. And from that, my scientist brain would say, I think she's from Lebanon, because I'm clever like that. And what's noteworthy, therefore, is if she's Lebanese, it's impossible that she's the bride of Christ. The bride of Christ can be one of two things. She can be said to be from every nation. That makes good sense. Possibly even Australia. You never know. Or she can be said to be of only one nation, provided that nation is Israel. Okay. What she cannot be is from one nation which is not Israel. That's just common sense. She cannot be Ecuadorian only, or Guatemalan, or French, or anything like that, or Lebanese. Okay. So there's a lot more to it than that. But we'll just leave that there, as we must press on with our own task today. I have covered my bed, says the seductress, with colored linens from Egypt. Somehow, when you see me, you'll have some hint of the Egyptian about me. Not because Egypt's being targeted as a country, except that it is the precedental captor of God's people. For the Lebanese bride, Solomon says, you know, I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Not amongst the chariot horses of Israel, or the chariot horses of any other country, but the chariot of horses, for some reason, I just see Egypt in you. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because there it is. And she acknowledges that she is foreign to him just with these verses. If only you were like to me like a brother, then if I found you outside, I could kiss you and no one would despise me, which is merely saying a brother in nationality. But I am from a different nation, and that's why I'm being despised by those who witness this relationship. Don't really need that verse. I have perfumed my bed, says the seductress, with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. And we've said, Myrrh and aloes, either is representative of death. We see that symbol. For the Lebanese bride, our bed is verdant, she says. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens, henna, nard, and saffron, calamus and cinnamon with myrrh and aloes, saved for the closing punchline, if you will. And so their bed also is perfumed with cinnamon and myrrh and aloes. Potentially another coincidence, but I really don't think so. With persuasive words, she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once, he followed her. So he follows her, not realizing that he's going to end up ensnared and entrapped, leading down to the chambers of death, or the chambers of myrrh, if you like. And how does the Lebanese bride end up conversing? When we get to the very end, this is the last verse, realize, of the entire book. Come away, my beloved. Realize that's come away from Jerusalem, which is where they are. Come away from Jerusalem and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains which are laden with spices. And more explicitly, as Solomon himself will announce, until the day breaks and the shadows flee. In other words, all night, again, there's that night metaphor, all through the night, I will go to the mountain of death. I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. That's my direction. That's where she's calling me. That's where I'm going to go. And so just as with Lady Wisdom, whom we were able to identify as being given a worked example through the Book of Ruth, so with the seductress Hedonism, are we able to identify an actual worked example that we can see in the Song of Songs. And when we see the Song of Songs interpreted in this manner, I don't want to say correctly because that's arrogant, just because it's my interpretation, but I believe so. When we see the Song of Songs actually for what it is, describing what it really says, then we're able to see these three consecutive books of the Bible are talking about one big framework story, amongst many other things. It's not the only thing they teach. But it's good to see these bigger patterns that Proverbs is throwing out the hypothetical cases or the abstract perfection of Lady Wisdom and the seductress, and then following them up with saying, well, if you want to see this in human form, it's going to look like this, and shows you the next two books of the Bible of Lady Wisdom and the seductress herself. So there's the scroll order again, and it makes sense to me now. Solomon is the one who says, where may she be found, Wisdom? Or, if you prefer a different question, which woman are you going to end up with? With whom are you going to form a relationship? Because it's going to be someone. In this sense, in this, you're never going to be single or stay single. You can find Lady Wisdom, the next book, or you can find the seductress. And after this book comes the scroll of Ecclesiastes. And one of the largest themes in Ecclesiastes, let me paraphrase, is, oh my goodness, I just married the wrong woman. Right? Is that fair? That's what he's saying in terms of all the riches and the pleasures that he pursued. Oh my goodness, I just married the wrong woman. And the good news is, I only did it 1,000 times. So it's not too bad here. That's all right. And that's obviously doing a disservice to Ecclesiastes to summarize it quite that shortly. But I think you may agree that is actually what's being said. The song, would you believe it, is written as a chiasm. That's rather fun, isn't it? Let's see how. And it's nice to go through the whole song and have it in front of you. It's going to take far too long, but turn it up by all means if you wish to. What you'll find out is it starts with the king in Jerusalem. It's a very happy scene. It's a very royal scene. He says, I am sitting at my table. Or the king is sat at his table. And I understand, therefore, why, if you're going to take that as Jesus, which it isn't, then you'd say, oh, it must be the kingdom, because that's when Jesus sits at his table. That's absolutely true. But it's not the scene being described here. There is scenes of joy and plenty in the richness, the natural richness of fruits and blossoms, which are shown throughout chapter 2. And they're quite timeless. The Jews read the song at Passover in April because they say, well, it's a springtime feel to it. Well, that's actually not true. If you look closely, it's every form of natural richness. It's the blossoms that turn up in the spring and the fruits that show up in the autumn. It's quite timeless. It just says, here's all the richness. Here's all the joy and plenty that we have in the natural world. And the king gets married right there in chapter 3. He takes his bride, and you can see, look, there is King Solomon sitting wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him, etc., gaining his bride. And next, and he says, we've seen that verse, come with me from Lebanon, my bride, come with me from Lebanon, from the haunts of the leopards and the lion's dens. And then, right in the middle of the book, and this time it is also a literary perfection, the central couplet of the book, there's an odd number of couplets, and the absolute central couplet, ignore those irritating chapter breaks, which should always be thrown away, there is a sexual union of that king with that bride. And thereafter, their entire dynamic relationship flips. In the first half of the book, he and he alone leads. He gives geographical direction. Come with me. You, come here. Follow me. Those directions remain in the second half of the book, and it's always her giving them. And she says, you come here. You come with me. So in the first half of the book, he leads her exclusively. In the second half of the book, after that one verse, she leads him exclusively. Complete flip around. She directs the king, you come here. The king says, I am enslaved. I think he says by your long hair. Something about the tresses of your long hair have actually kept me captive and enslaved me. There are scenes of spiritual poverty as he calls to those indulging in hedonism or those who dwell in gardens. He says, let me hear your voice. I want to take direction from you. I'm not king anymore. You tell me what to do. Those who dwell in gardens with something in abundance, let me hear your voice. And finally, in the last verse of the song, the king is lured away from Jerusalem. Come away. And the Hebrew actually says flee away. Flee away, my beloved. Come with me and let us play on the mountains of myrrh, on the mountains of spices. Okay. So it's the same as the book of Ruth, really, isn't it? You see, there's, again, these are exact couplets. There is a king in Jerusalem. There is a king pulled out of Jerusalem. There are scenes of joy and plenty. There are scenes of spiritual poverty. The king gets married and gains his bride, and then the king actually falls enslaved to his bride, and the dynamic of leadership flips 180 degrees from the one to the other. The king calls his bride from Lebanon, but then the Lebanese bride directs the king thereafter. And so you have this axis of glory, and the first half of the book has these glorious and wonderful scenes. Then around this fulcrum of the sexual union of the king and the bride, the axis of tragedy that ends with the king actually pulled away from the throne of Jerusalem itself and set apart on the mountains of spices. The essence of hedonism, therefore, and again, is this therefore condemning sexual union? Absolutely not. Because in each of these cases, what you're looking at is God. Choosing Israel's God as God is a good idea, but choosing the pursuit of sexual activity as God is the bad idea. It's not a condemnation of sexual activity, it's a condemnation of hedonism, if you understand what I mean. In other words, sex as a religion, as something to fill your life with. The essence of hedonism, for don't forget, of course, this is an emblematic bride. Solomon had 1,000 consorts. The essence of hedonism disconnects with Jerusalem. And so, therefore, it's rather nice. And this is our last slide. We'll spend a couple of minutes on it because there's a lot there. But there they are together. These are the two books that follow the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs posed the question, where can I find her? Where can I find wisdom? Where may she be found? The title of this talk. And the next two books will show you, well, there is a Lady Wisdom and there is a seductress. And here's a worked example of each one. And so these couplets are opposites of each other, as you've seen. But what's really interesting is that the opposites work horizontally as well as vertically, don't they? Do you see that? If you abandon Israel for Moab because of the famine, that's the opposite to seeing the king enthroned in a healthy Jerusalem. So those two are opposites. Which means if those are opposites and those are opposites, then the diametrically opposed should be pretty much identical. Leaving Israel for Moab should be the same as the king abandoning Jerusalem for the mountains of pleasures. Well, it is. That's right. And you should be able to, you can do it with your eyes at your leisure. You can run up and down those branches as much as you want. It'll always work. Famine and mourning is opposite to joy and plenty, but the same as famine and mourning and the opposite of joy and plenty. Ruth loses her husband, is the opposite of a king gaining a husband, which is the opposite of a king being enslaved to his husband, which is the opposite of Ruth gaining a husband. Right? The opposites work all the way around. Naomi saying to Ruth, why don't you just go back to Moab? Nothing for you in Israel. Is the opposite of the king saying, no, come out of Lebanon. Come to me in Jerusalem. And likewise, we've been around them. Ruth comes to Bethlehem, is the opposite of the bride directing the king away from his duties. Ruth gaining a husband is the opposite of the king enslaved to the bride. Joy and plenty is the opposite of spiritual poverty. And the king being born, the king of Jerusalem being born is the opposite to the king being lured out of Jerusalem. And how ironic it is that the king who is born here, his name is David, is the father of the very one who did everything backwards and wrong. And the king who leaves Jerusalem is the son of the one who treated the throne respectfully and properly and served the people as well as any human could. So the fulcrums in each case, we have the spirituality, the choice to follow God, to explore the world unseen, as I think it's Hebrews says, don't be distracted by a physical world, look at the real world instead. The real world isn't what lands on your retina. The real world is what's behind even that. Against the god of hedonism, the god of pleasure, pleasure for pleasure's sake and only pleasure. And if you think this is kind of exploring books written long ago for some ancient historical lesson, goodness me, when has the power of hedonism been stronger than today? The only time hedonism is going to be stronger than today is tomorrow. Right? This isn't going backwards. Right? It's only going to get stronger and stronger. And that's just a beautiful structure that I see. What you're looking at there also forms the letter X. And in Greek, of course, the X-shaped letter is the letter chi. And that's the whole basis for calling it a chiasm in the first place. It wasn't just a made-up word for no reason. So Ruth is a half chiasm, really, you know, technically. The song is a half chiasm, and you put the two together, and you have an absolute full chiasm. And that's why that word comes about, just because that shaped letter in Greek is called chi. But much more important than the letters, much more important than the shape, is the beautiful picture that allows us to see. And so by reading the Bible very carefully and trying to get rid of preconceived ideas, just listening carefully and gently to what it's saying, over a number of years, that has kind of somehow melted out from a collection of stuck thoughts and has formed a beautiful pattern before me. And that's, in my view, whether you agree with it, if you agree with it at least, is one of the most beautiful things that I've ever seen in X years of Bible study. And I'm delighted to the people who ran this school for giving me the opportunity to share it with you. Thank you.